Law of Tort. The law of tort is notoriously difficult to define. Thalmond, himself a jurist and judge, defined tort as a civil wrong for which the remedy is a common law action for unliquidated damages, and which is not exclusively the breach of a contract or the breach of trust or other merely equitable obligation. The Law of Torts, Thalmond and Heuston, 1957. While also implying the function and purpose of the law of torts, the definition emphasises a tort as being a wrongful act or omission, id est a civil wrong, for which the law provides compensation in the form of unliquidated rather than liquidated damages for the person wronged. This wrong is independent of a breach of contract or a breach of trust. Thus, like the principle of a measure of damages in contract we noted before, the principle of a measure of damages in tort is applied. The interests protected. Tort law provides remedy in cases of personal injury and property damage caused by a tortfeasor or wrongdoer. Persons who are jointly and severally liable for such injury or damage are called joint tortfeasors. The most common form of tort is the tort of negligence. The essence of this tort is that individuals will owe a duty of care to those who might foreseeably be injured by their actions. Failure to exercise the appropriate standard of care, which results in damage to another, will give rise to tortious liability. Later in the examination, you will be told that tort law also protects other interests, such as reputation, defamation, personal freedom, assault, false imprisonment, enjoyment of property, nuisance. In tort law, it must usually be shown that the wrong was done intentionally or negligently. In other words, the defendant must be at fault, id est individually responsible for, culpable. Most torts are actionable only if they have caused damage. However, torts such as trespass, whose main function is to protect title to property rather than to compensate for damage, are actionable per se. This means that they provide in themselves sufficient grounds for bringing an action without the need to prove that actual damage has been suffered. This rule applies to torts of strict or absolute liability, where, as a result, liability for a wrong arises without the need for the claimant to prove that the defendant was at fault. This contrasts with crimes of strict liability, where liability arises without the need to prove mens rea with respect to one or more of the elements which constitute the criminal offence. We have seen that it is the tortfeasor who is principally liable in a tort action, exempli gratia, action in negligence. But the law of vicarious liability recognises that liability may be imposed on a person for a tort committed by another. Vicarious liability, or vicarious responsibility, arises when a person is liable for the acts of another because of the relationship between them. The most common example is the relationship between an employer and employee, the former being liable for the acts or omissions of his employees committed during the course of employment. This is a very important notion in tort law and less relevant to the idea of fault in criminal law. Distinguishing a tort. Some torts are breaches of contract, In many circumstances, particularly professional activities, there can be a concurrent liability in negligence and contract, which entitles the aggrieved party to a remedy. The classic example of negligent driving by a taxi driver, which causes injury to his passenger, will be both the tort of negligence and a breach of the contract to carry the passenger safely to his destination. The passenger may sue either in tort or for breach of contract or both. However, many torts are also crimes. For example, assault and dangerous driving are both a crime and a tort. They may give rise to an action in tort if they cause injury to another person. This is the case of an act of A, defendant, which causes B, claimant, reasonable fear of the infliction of battery on him by A, or personal injury caused by driving dangerously. Or if A steals B's car, A commits both a crime of theft and trespass to goods, a tort. The flowchart shows you that criminal law is concerned with public duties, binding on all individuals and enforced by the state. The law of contract is concerned with private and voluntary duties arising from agreement, freedom of contract, and enforced by the individuals concerned. In contract, a person is liable if he breaks his promises. The law of tort concerns public duties, binding on all individuals, imposed externally by law, and left to individuals to enforce. In negligence, a person is liable if he is at fault, the fault-based liability coinciding with the standard of care expected of the reasonable man. The flowchart also reminds you of the different purposes of contract, tort, and criminal law, as we already examined. Types of tort. As noted, the law of tort provides remedies for a variety of wrongs, such as negligence, the unintentional interference with another's person or property, trespass, the intentional and direct interference with another's person, land or property, nuisance, the indirect and unreasonable interference with another's land, defamation, the lowering of another's reputation. Negligence. This is a more precise concept than simple carelessness and amounts to the culpable breach of a legal duty to take care. What this means in practice is that the standard of conduct to be attained is that of the reasonable man. Negligence is a type of tort under which a person whose property has been damaged or who has suffered injury through someone else's negligent action can claim damages from him. It is only actionable upon proof of damage by the claimant. To succeed in a negligent action, the claimant must prove that the damage suffered discloses a cause of action, the facts that entitle the claimant to sue. The defendant owed the claimant a duty of care. He had a responsibility towards him in law. The defendant breached the duty of care. He had acted in a negligent way. The breach of duty was a cause in fact of the claimant's damage. The injuries were a direct result of these negligent actions. The claimant's damage was a reasonably foreseeable consequence of the defendant's breach of duty. In case law, these requirements are often summarised as duty, breach, causation, damage. In the most celebrated and influential case in English legal history, Donoghue and Stevenson, 1932, Lord Atkins defined to whom a legal responsibility is owed. Obviously, whether damage can be the subject of a valid negligence claim depends on whether a court is convinced the defendant owed the claimant a duty of care not to cause the particular injury. Usually, the claim is for personal injury, physical damage to property, psychiatric injury or nervous shock, or financial loss, such as loss of earnings or loss of profit, in which case the claimant's loss is said to be damage to the pocket or pure economic loss. However, in a claim for negligence, a duty of care is only owed to those people that a reasonable man could foresee would be affected by his actions. This means that it is irrelevant whether the defendant himself foresaw the claimant would be affected. He will owe a duty of care if a reasonable man would have foreseen it in the circumstances. However, damage which is not reasonably foreseeable is regarded as too remote from the breach, remoteness of damage, and therefore not recoverable. If the claimant has met the requirements explained above, the defendant will be liable unless he is able to invoke a defence, id est the defendant's denial of the facts alleged in the claim. In a claim for negligence, two defences are normally available. Contributory negligence, which is when the claimant's damage is caused in part to his own negligent actions and therefore justifies reducing the amount of damages payable by the defendant. This is a partial defence which allows the court to share out liability between the claimant and the defendant, since the former contributed towards the accident which caused the injury, exempli gratiae, not wearing seat belts. Thus, the defendant was contributorily negligent. Volenti non fit injuria. No cause of action arises where someone has willingly taken a risk. She or he is a volunteer. Volenti, consent to the risk, is a complete defence to a tort of negligence. However, the circumstances in which it may be invoked are limited because the courts prefer to find the claimant contributory negligent and not consenting to the risk of the injury. The defence is limited to cases of public and private transport, as well as business liability. A, who accepts a lift from B, a driver, who he knows is drunken, will normally be held as contributory negligent. Thus, the claimant consented to run the risk of the injury, volenti. Trespass. This is a direct and unjustifiable interference with someone else's person or property, which entitles the injured person to seek compensation. In Entnick and Carrington, 1756, it was held that every invasion of private property, be it ever so minute, is a trespass. For example, if A throws a log and it hits B, this is trespass. If the log lands in the road and B later trips over it, this is a case of negligence. There can be three forms of trespass. 1. Trespass to person, assault, putting someone in fear of suffering, immediate physical force, exempli gratia, threatening to hit them, as when A advances towards B, shakes his fist, threatening to beat B, therefore putting B in fear of immediate violence. Battery, directly applying physical force to someone which may or may not be forceful enough to cause injury. Exempi gratia, kissing someone without their consent. False imprisonment, preventing someone from exercising freedom of movement. Exempli gratia, locking someone in a room, wrongfully arresting someone, or preventing a person from walking in the direction he wants to go in if there is no reasonable alternative route. 2. Trespass to goods, intentionally or negligently interfering with the goods in the ownership or possession of another person. It includes touching, moving, or carrying goods away, exempli gratia, throwing another's book out of the window, removing a bicycle from a shed. 3. Trespass to land, intentionally or negligently interfering with land which is in the possession of another person, exempli gratia, throwing bricks onto another's land. Trespass to land may take 3 forms: entering on the land of another, remaining on the land of another, and placing or throwing any material object upon the land of another. In the above cases, the trespass must not have caused any damage for an action to be brought against the trespasser. As noted, it is actionable per se. 4. Trespass ab initio, trespass from the beginning, is another form of wrongdoing recognised by law. The essence of this tort can be explained as follows. Where a person is given a right to go onto someone else's land by authority of law, for example, to arrest someone, and then the same person commits a wrong by subsequent conduct, id est abuse of right of entry, by stealing an article from the occupier's land, his action is treated as trespass from the very beginning he enters the land. The abuse must consist of a misfeasance, some positive act of wrongdoing, such as stealing, rather than a non-feasance, an omission to perform an act by law. The following are the defences available to a trespasser. Consent. In a claim for battery, the defendant will not be liable if the claimant agreed to it and the action served a socially useful purpose, exempli gratia, surgical operations. The claimant's consent must have been given freely, not under duress. The law treats this type of defence as being similar to volenti non fit injuria in negligence. Necessity. The defendant will not be liable if he can show that he was compelled by the circumstance to prevent further harm from happening, exempli gratia, entering a neighbour's land to put out a dangerous fire. Thus, damage done intentionally will be excused if done from necessity. Inevitable accident. The defendant will not be liable if he can show that the accident could not have been avoided by exercising ordinary care and skill. Statutory authority. The defendant will not be liable if he can show that he carried out an act which he had been given the authority to do under an Act of Parliament. In other words, the defence authorises the alleged wrong. Nuisance. This is an act, or more usually a series of acts, by one person which interferes with the life of another. There are two types of nuisance. Private nuisance. This occurs when a person's use or enjoyment of his land is unreasonably affected by the activities carried out by a neighbour. For example, a neighbour who continually plays loud music. Public nuisance. This occurs when a neighbour carries out an act which materially affects the comfort, health, or safety of the public at large. sometimes referred to as Her Majesty's subjects. Common examples include quarrying and blasting that cause dust, noise and vibration that affect a whole neighbourhood, obstruction of the highway, selling food unfit for human consumption. The basis of liability here is the failure to meet the reasonable expectations of one's neighbours, and a civil action will only be available to a person on his own, not a group of people, who has property rights, id est, owners, lessees, or exclusive possession. The main remedies for an action in nuisance are damages and injunction. In deciding whether a private nuisance has occurred, the court will take into account the effect of the nuisance, that is, whether it interfered with the enjoyment of land, noise, or caused damage, fumes, which damages plants. Thus, in the case of noise, a claimant will ask the court to stop the nuisance by an injunction, and in the case of damage, will ask for damages and an injunction. As we saw earlier about injunction, this remedy lies in the discretion of the court and will only be granted where it is just and equitable to do so. However, a self-help remedy called abatement of nuisance is also available. This occurs when a person suffering from a nuisance takes steps himself to stop a nuisance, usually after asking the creator of the nuisance to stop. In deciding whether enough people have been affected by the nuisance to make it a public nuisance, the courts will look at whether enough people were affected. The person who has suffered more than the rest of the group may bring claim, that is, asking the court for an injunction to stop the nuisance or suing for damages, as explained above. Or the Attorney General may bring a criminal prosecution if public nuisance amounts to a crime, such as in the tort of trespass to land, where the trespasser intends to disrupt a lawful activity. The latter claim is known as criminal relator action because the action is brought by the Attorney General at the relation of, on behalf of, the affected public to enforce some public right. Defamation. This is the publication of a statement which is likely to lower the person referred to in the estimation of right-thinking members of society. Defamation is usually in words, although other acts such as pictures and gestures can also be defamatory. There can be two types of defamation, libel and slander. While libel is a defamatory statement which is made in a permanent form, exempli gratia, writing, picture, broadcast, slander is a statement which is made in a temporary form, almost always spoken. The person who libels someone is called libeler, while the person who slanders someone is called slanderer. The basis of the tort in defamation is injury to reputation, in which case two civil remedies are granted by the court to a defamed party: damages and injunction. To bring a claim in defamation, the claimant has to prove that 1. The statement was defamatory, that is, the meaning of apparently innocent words being alleged is defamatory. 2. The statement referred to the claimant by name or was clear to refer to him by what was said, and that the statement was published. 3. In the case of slander only, that the claimant has suffered loss. So it is not necessary to prove that the defendant intended to refer to the claimant, because a reasonable man test will be applied. Id est whether reasonable people would think the defamatory statement referred to the claimant. Under these circumstances, therefore, the defendant may escape liability by relying on the following defences. Unintentional defamation. The defendant acted innocently but has offered to make a suitable correction of the statement and apology to the defamed party, to pay compensation and any legal costs. For these reasons, the defence is also referred to as offer of amend and apology. Justification. The defamatory statement was substantially true. Fair comment. This is a defamatory opinion rather than a defamatory statement of fact, given on a matter of public rather than private interest. Absolute privilege. These are statements made in Parliament and in judicial proceedings. Qualified privilege. These are statements made because of a moral or legal duty, such as when a person has a duty to provide information and the person to whom the information refers has a duty or interest to receive it. All such defences can be invoked by the defendant, provided the statements were not prompted by malice, id est, one of the required state of mind such as intention or recklessness, which would otherwise amount to the intentional tort of defamation.